And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I've worked with many fine reporters over the years, but right at the top of the list is my CNN colleague, Dana Bash, who is at once a great reporter with wonderful sources, smart analyst, and a very, very good person. Dana just did a web series called Badass Women of Washington, which is really a great watch. I sat down with her the other day to talk about her career, how Congress has changed over the years, and the current debate over health care. Dana Bash, always good to see you.
It's such an honor to be here.
You come by this journalism thing honestly.
Well, thank you. You can just end this now.
Your dad was a really highly decorated television news producer for 4 decades. So you grew up around all of this.
I did. I grew up in control rooms. Very much so.
And did you think to yourself, I read somewhere that you wanted to be a rock star at one point.
I did. There's only one problem.
Can't sing?
At all.
Yeah, that's an impediment.
Just ask my son.
So, but when did you start thinking, yeah, I'd like to do this. This would be interesting.
What's so interesting is that I fought against what's really my DNA for my whole childhood, even as I got into college. I always said to myself, I don't want to do this. Like, the Pope dies. You got to go home from your vacation. The hours are crazy. You know, because so my eyes were wide open about the downsides of this business. And then I just stopped fighting my DNA as soon as I went to college. Because my dad ended up working in TV news, but both my parents went to Northwestern and studied journalism there. Uh-huh. And my parents actually met at the local ABC station in Chicago.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
WLS.
Yep. And in fact, my mom basically got my dad the job because she was working there as a secretary, which is what you did when you were a woman then. And she was very good at ironing her boss's pants. I'm not making it up.
Really?
Uh-huh. And my father, I think, had been doing basic training. It was during the Vietnam era. He was in the National Guard. But he came in for an interview, and my mom said to the boss, "Oh, I remember him from school. He's a really good writer, and so she helped get him hired." And 6 months later, they were engaged.
And his pants were nicely creased.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. 6 months later, they were engaged, and the rule was at the time, then he was going to work for the network. They were moving to New York to work for ABC News, and the rule was you couldn't be married and work for the same company,
even if it
was in the affiliate. And so, of course, it was my mom.
Oh, that's grossly unfair.
Totally. And it was my mom who decided that she went on a completely different path after that.
This DNA thing is powerful. You know, I'm always embarrassed to concede that my mother, who was one of the first women in a newsroom in New York, she worked for a paper called PM in the 1940s.
I didn't know that. That's so cool.
She was a freelance journalist after that, magazine writer. And she named my sister and me, she said, because she thought our names would look good in bylines.
That is awesome.
Yeah, so it's embarrassing because I ended up becoming a newspaper reporter, and it's like you don't want to feel like those tracks were laid for you, but
it's
powerful when you grow up around it. And your mom, she had a big influence on you as well because she later in life she dove into Jewish studies, and faith is big for her and in your family. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so she, you know, left journalism. She did so many different things when I was growing up. I mean, I don't want to say latchkey child, but I guess by today's standards, you would call it that. And looking back, it was great for me that my mom was always working, even though she wasn't doing the field that she studied. But she worked in publishing. She actually worked, when we were here in D.C., when my dad was working in D.C., she was working at a place that was lobbying, a whole bunch of different stuff. But her passion was always, and her love was always, Jewish learning. And so,
why?
I think it's probably, lots of reasons. My grandfather, her father, was definitely the smartest person I ever met, but mostly self-taught. He escaped the Nazis along with my grandmother. He was Austrian. And he was going to go to law school, and then that just didn't happen for him because they were trying to figure out how to stay alive and then ultimately get to the United States. but he always he was always fascinated with learning, always. And so he that was most of his focus. His day job was kind of a sideshow for him, how he made his money. And he was always very into sort of the intellectual part of Judaism. He was spiritual, but it was more about kind of the Talmudic part of it for him. And that definitely kind of was part of my mother's upbringing, and it was always where she had her interest. And so, I mean, just remember growing up, again, she also had her day job, and she had us, my brother and me, but she loved going to going to temple and being on boards and being involved, particularly in the crafting of education within the temple, and you know, not just kids, but mostly adult education. And so when my brother and I were out of the house, she said, I'm going to go back to school. And she went to get her master's in Judaic studies. She was actually the first person to get that degree from the Reform Seminary. Everybody else who was going to school with her, they were actually my age at the time, going to be rabbis. And she got her master's, and then she went on to help try to, you know, devise curriculum for adults, sort of when they drop their kids at Hebrew school, to keep them engaged and keep them involved, which is a big challenge in the Reformed Jewish movement, a big one. And so, and she wrote a couple of books with her hero, one of her, Eugene Borowitz, who was one of her professors. And so she kind of found her home there.
And one of them was called Jewish Moral Virtues.
You did your homework, David Axelrod.
Well, it's, people do homework for me, but I read it, but I read it voraciously. But it interested me because, I mean, I will confess, I mean, I'm Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed. My family, my grandfather was Orthodox. He was an immigrant. It seemed, all that seemed very compulsory to me. And what I look back at now with regret is that the sort of deeper meaning and lessons of the faith that went more to character, morality, and so on, those weren't stressed. It was it was more the triumph of form over content. So for you, what did it mean? Did you internalize things from faith that inform you?
You know, the answer should be yes, based on what
I was hoping
did and does, but certainly not in a conscious way at all. But I think looking back, probably in a subconscious way, because I followed the lead of my parents, even though I still don't believe that they actually talked to me because I was such a rotten teenager. But I did finally come back home, and I think that that all was just kind of part of who I am and who I was, just by osmosis, living in the house that I did.
So, you know, one of the things that has struck me lately with all of this discussion about immigrants, about refugees and so on, is my father was a refugee from Eastern Europe. And you know, it does kind of formulate my thinking on this because I know what America meant to him and his family.
Absolutely.
And I'm always proud of the fact that America is a country that's been sort of a beacon to people all over the world who are looking for freedom and opportunity and so on. I ask you, it's a question really about how you separate out your own personal experience from your role as a very fine political reporter who's expected to be objective.
It's so funny that you're so good that you hit on that, because this was one of the toughest ones. There's no question, because my grandfather passed away in 2009. He was 95. And so I got a lot of time with him that I treasure. And one of the things that we did as a family in the 90s, the mid-90s, like I think it was 1996, is my brother, who's 2 years younger than me, and I and my parents and my mom's sister, my aunt, and my grandfather, the six of us, did what my grandfather called his sentimental journey. And we spent 2 weeks in Europe. We went to Vienna, to the city where he was born and raised. We went to Prague, the city where he and my grandmother were married on the run, where he was stateless. He had to give up his papers. He showed us the mountains that he escaped on and from with gypsies helping him along the way. We went to the town where my grandmother was from in Hungary, Košice, which I don't even think is Hungary anymore. And it was leveled, so he couldn't even figure out what was water, where was where, and he was very upset about it. But The whole time, the whole trip, what he just drilled into us over and over again was when he was there, and he didn't get out till 1941, Columbus Day of 1941, mm-hmm. which is really late, is Hitler and the Nazis, for so long, they didn't want to kill us. They just wanted us out, and there was nowhere for us to go. We had no place to go. He even trained with his Zionist cousins to go to Israel, and they didn't go only because the Danube froze. And that's the only reason why he came to America and, you know, I am here. But over and over again, that was his whole message. We didn't have anywhere to go. And he was the biggest American patriot. I mean, he loved this country. Loved, loved, loved. 4th of July was his favorite holiday. I mean, and so he rings in my ears, David. And I almost, and during that whole, the whole Syrian debate, I was actually, I mean, certainly not glad that my grandfather wasn't with us. He would have been over 100, but still thinking, I'm glad he would have just been so sickened just to hear the back and forth about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, 2 years after my father arrived in 1924, Congress passed a very draconian anti-immigration bill that set a very hard quota on various groups, including Jews, and that prevented Jewish immigrants from coming to this country throughout the 30s.
Yep.
And helped compound this, you know, what is a monumental
disaster. That's exactly right. I mean, he always
disaster
said
disaster in the Holocaust.
Yeah, he always said, you know, FDR was such a great president for so many reasons, but this was a big blind spot that he allowed to happen, keeping those quotas in place.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. He and my grandmother only got to this country because his brother was a chemist. His father owned paint factories. They did very well, which of course were all burned to the ground by the Nazis, but he was a chemist who came to Chicago to work, and he had a boss who loved him, loved my uncle, my great uncle. And he agreed to sign an affidavit, which you had to do. It was like the bare minimum to get somebody over here. And it was like $20,000 a person, which was a lot of money back then.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
But in today's dollars, that's astounding.
Astounding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you went to George Washington University.
I did.
And
go Colonials.
You said that's when you really geared into being a reporter. Mm-hmm. I read a story about you and your roommate going to see George Stephanopoulos when he spoke there. Tell that story.
So I was I graduated from GW in 1993. So I was here in Washington as a student in, you know, kind of the climax of the Clinton Gore craze, which it really was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was at the time, it was the next generation. It was all the things that you saw, you know, so many years later with you and your candidate with Barack Obama. But it was, and also the people who worked for him were really, really young, like people who we as students could relate to, because they were only a few years older than we were. And George was one of those.
George just about beginning to look his age right now.
It's about time. And so my roommate in college was Melina Zacharopoulos, and I decided that she should marry George Stephanopoulos, because why shouldn't she? And she was drop-dead
gorgeous.
Can
you imagine what a big, fat Greek wedding that would have been?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, drop-dead gorgeous. She's just super, super smart. She was majoring in philosophy. I mean, she was the full package. So we went to hear him speak. It was after the election. They had won, and he was a superstar, a real superstar. And I was trying to figure out ways to... And I didn't know him from a hole in the wall. He didn't know me from the hole in the wall. So I was trying to devise ways for them to bump into each other, because I knew as soon as he bumped into Melina Zacharopoulos, he would decide that she was the one for him, but I didn't figure it out.
Didn't happen.
No.
And history his loss. Take a different
Although course. Allie's a great, great person.
How did your roommate do?
She did great.
Okay.
She did great.
Good.
She's great.
Well,
she's happy,
well.
Happily married, 3 kids, great life.
So you did a lot of interning and stringing and... When you were in college, talk about that experience and how formative was that for you?
It was incredibly formative because I really, my sophomore year, I applied to and got into a program at GW called Political Communication, which was tremendous. It was all about, it was political science, journalism, communications, and then it was government and kind of how they all interact, which was kind of a great you know, training ground for what we do now.
Yes.
But even though I got in there and I was doing that, I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. I wasn't sure if I wanted to work in public relations. I wasn't sure if I wanted to work in politics. And so because I was here in D.C., I had so many opportunities to work, not just in the summertime, but during the school year and intern. And I took advantage of it. I did. I interned for Capital Cities, the parent company for ABC, in their corporate communications department. I worked with the best people, but I realized I did not. That was not for me. So I actually think, and I tell this to young people all the time, interning is as much about figuring out what you don't want to do as it is what you do want to do. So I figured that out. And then I was on the Hill for, I did a couple days a week, one semester for Don Regal of Michigan.
Yeah, former senator
from Michigan, who I had no connection to. It was just somebody who was a professor, knew that they needed somebody. And I did a little bit of volunteering, answering phones in the press shop in the White House my second semester, my senior year. And I got and after I had done internships at CBS News here in Washington, at NBC News on the desk in New York, actually during the 92 campaign, I was able to go to the convention in New York in 92, which was really cool. And then my last semester of my senior year when I was here, at the time, internships weren't paid. Now most of them are, but they weren't. And I thought, you know, it would be nice if I actually made some money doing this. So I had like a three-person deep connection here at CNN, and I just happened to call on a day where this person, his name was Bill Kazarba, who ran the newsroom at the time, was getting an earful from the person who works in the feeds room because there were only two people who could do it.
Explain what the feeds room is.
Well, the feeds room doesn't really exist anymore. But at the time, the feeds room was, it was actually a little closet where you had VCRs for young people. VCR was this thing where you put an actual tape in.
Yes.
And you would actually.
And then explain what newspapers are.
Exactly. I know when I'm done with this. And so there were probably eight VCRs, and you're responsible for literally pressing play and record to make sure you get the Senate floor, the House floor, the stakeout at the White House, the White House briefing. And if you don't record it, you're kind of hosed because the network doesn't have it. I mean, you can get a copy from C-SPAN or somebody, but it wasn't digital. I mean, it was a big deal to get a videotape copy. So that, and then when the reporters did packages, reports, it was all put together on a videotape, and you had to take the videotape and put it in the VCR and press play and send it down to Atlanta so it could get on the air. Again, none of this exists anymore. It's all old technology, but there were only two people who did it, and when one person would take a vacation or was sick, that person had worked from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. So there were this guy, Bill Kazarba, was getting an earful, like, I need help, and I just happened to call that day, and he said, okay, you want to come in, come learn the feeds room? I said, okay. I had no idea what that meant, but I came in and worked with somebody who was also still at CNN. She's an editor now, who taught me the feeds room, and I came in and learned that. And then,
year was that?
That was 1993. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated from college, there was a job open in the tape library, another place that doesn't exist anymore because there's no tapes and there's no library. But that was really the only way to get in. There were no real entry-level jobs here at CNN in the Washington Bureau. The tape library and the receptionist in the front hall, they were the only entry-level jobs, and then you could kind of work your way up from there. So I was lucky that there was a job open, which didn't happen very often, and I applied and I got it. So I got it on my 22nd birthday, and I've been here ever since.
I heard that you had an interesting initiation to feeding scripts into the teleprompter.
Oh.
Machine.
You know, even to this day, when you mention it, my stomach gets a little queasy because it was so horrible. What happened was, at the time, the teleprompter was like a conveyor belt. And so the scripts were printed, and if the script was long, you had like script number one was 1A, B, C, and D. And you had to actually tape with a piece of scotch tape, tape them together in order. It's the right way to do it, put it in order, and put it on the conveyor belt so that the anchor is reading it. And there was a little camera that went on the conveyor belt and went into the teleprompter. Well, as part of my duties in the feeds room, nobody told me that it also included being basically the production assistant for a show that was like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I had no idea what I was doing, none. And there were, because there were no real entry-level jobs, the people who really did know what they were doing were the actual interns, the people who weren't getting paid, who were in school, who had a little bit more experience doing it. Long story short, it got totally messed up, and it was like 1A, 1D, 1E, and the anchor was reading, who ended up being my boss and a mentor to me. But the anchor,
you're going to name the anchor?
Frank says no,
uh-huh.
But he denies this, and I want to say that he is the nicest guy. But what happened, understandably, was he was hung out to dry, came into the control room after the show, was very upset, and was talking to the producer about it. And he looked at me and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "My name is Dana. It's my first day." He goes, "Oh, yeah? Well, it's going to be your last." Like, out of a movie. And I went to the bathroom and threw up.
So that seems like the right way to handle it.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Dana Bash. So, you know, I did a podcast with Joe Madden, who's the manager of the Chicago Cubs, mm-hmm. and then I actually wrote a piece for the New Yorker about the Cubs, and I talked to people about Joe, and the thing that he said and that they said was one of the things that has served him well was that he's done everything in baseball. Mm-hmm. He had been a hitting instructor. He had been, you know, a minor league coach and manager and scout, and he understood all of these different roles, and reading your history, it strikes mm-hmm. me that you're a little bit the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've done everything, but you spent a lot of time for CNN when you finally got out of all of those jobs, that those menial jobs, but important jobs, and you were a producer on The Hill mm-hmm. for years.
I was. And, you know, the thing about CNN is, particularly when I started, is that there were so few people. And at the time, there was no Fox, there was no MSNBC, so we were really the little engine that could still. And because there were so few people, if you wanted to do it, if you frankly had a pulse and an interest, you could go do it. So I got a lot more experience than I probably would have otherwise at a different place. But I did work my way through the weekend shows. I was an associate producer and a producer, which again got me so much experience in booking and writing and in package producing and figuring out how to get satellite time, things like that. But then I wanted to go to news gathering. I made a conscious decision that I wanted to see what it was like to actually report news. Not as a reporter. I didn't think I want to be a reporter, but I wanted to be where the action was. I wasn't sure. I genuinely wasn't sure. That wasn't my goal. I wasn't one of those people who said, "I want to be an on-air reporter." And if I were, I probably would have done the more traditional route and gone out to a local station. But I just loved this story. I loved politics. I loved Washington.
And you did a lot of reporting.
I did
in
a lot
the producer
of reporting.
Role.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened. So I was lucky in that I went to the assignment desk and I was doing some news gathering in terms of helping reporters on stories. The newsroom was set up in a different way than it is now. But at the end of the day, I ended up on Capitol Hill just helping out during the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. And Candy Crowley was a correspondent there, her producer Mike Roselli, and that was it, and they needed help. And so, it was all hands on deck, but I fell in love with it. I thought, this is so cool. You get to walk around and talk to actual senators and their actual aides and House members and have conversations with them and really learn. It's still, to me, the best beat in Washington because of the access that you have. They went on to cover the 2000 presidential election, and I got the job as Senate producer, which is effectively and still is. My colleague Ted Barrett has been in that job for a long time, and he's one of the best reporters
yeah.
on Capitol Hill, because it's news gathering and it's source building.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of your strengths, and I'd say this behind your back, is that you have good sources and you know how to work them. And the essence of good journalism is going out, not assuming you know, but mm-hmm. going out and asking questions of people who actually do know mm-hmm. What's going on. So, but that is the product of years of relationship building.
Right. Years. And being present. Just you're not sitting in the booth. There's a little, you know, booth where CNN has a little office space and all the networks and the print people have the same. But just literally roaming the halls. And just, and then you never know what you find. When you roam the halls, you see Senator X going into the office of Senator Y, and you know that Senator X is working on, you know, a certain piece of legislation, and you, oh, wow, is Senator Y maybe? And so you kind of learn how to piece things together just by being present.
And if you develop relationships and they know that they can trust you, not to burn sources, mm-hmm. and so on, generally people in public life can be more forthcoming than you'd think.
Absolutely.
Because they often aren't forthcoming when they're in front of a camera.
No question. And you probably had this experience when you were a reporter. I've gotten scooped on a lot of things that I was told off the record. But because I kept it off the record, and I didn't feel that I could even go elsewhere to try to confirm it because that would burn that person, I got scooped.
But it does pay off
at the
later.
Time. Exactly. Yeah. But it pays off later because you build relationships, and that trust factor is something that you can't, you can't put a value on.
One of the stories that you covered when you were there was the 9/11 mm-hmm. Attack. And talk about that day.
Oh, I still to this day really go into the rotunda of the Capitol, and I look up and I mean, I put my arms out, which is a ridiculous thing, but it just kind of helps me. And I think, okay, if a plane actually did hit, if Flight 93, which the 9/11 Commission said was heading for the Capitol, did hit the Capitol, how far, like the wingspan, how far out would it, what would it mean? And those are the things that still go through my mind thinking about that day of 9/11. And I was, when the second plane hit the towers, I was still on my way to the Capitol. I was a producer at the time. And it was such a different mindset that we could still park right on the Capitol grounds, even reporters. The cops did kind of do a perfunctory look in your trunk to make sure nothing was in there. But when they saw me coming, they were helping me get in because they knew that, we all know each other. It's like a family. And they were trying to help me get in because they knew I had to go work. And as I was coming up the east front of the Capitol, the plane was hitting the Pentagon, which they could see. The people in the offices on the west front could see out the window. They could see the smoke. And so the second I actually got into onto the first floor of the Capitol, I pressed the button for the elevator, and then the cops started screaming, "Everybody run, get out, we're being evacuated." So I ran out. Somehow, miraculously, a CNN camera guy was sort of right there. It was before live views or the technology was such that you could pretty much go live with a cell phone. You couldn't do that there. So he plugged in to a fiber drop, which allowed us to go live, which was right across from the Senate chamber, and we were about to just even put up a live picture. Already the cell phones were not working because everything was just jammed up. And then, this is probably one of the scariest moments I'll never forget, the police officers started to scream, run for your lives.
Oh, wow.
And we were all gathered across the plaza, kind of on the grass across from the Senate, and people just started running. I remember seeing shoes just kind of on the lawn because women were running out of their shoes. And to hear a police
officer...
Yeah,
run for your life doesn't sound like the right way to go.
Exactly. And it was because they didn't know where Flight 93 was.
Right.
And they thought it was coming. And at the end of the day, they were right. But the other thing that was not in place at the time were the basic kind of continuity of government things that we now know. Robert Byrd, who was president pro tem, he was third in line to be president of the United States, was wandering around. He didn't have any staff with him. He didn't know where to go. He was just kind of wandering around over by the Supreme Court. I mean, it was mayhem. It was absolute mayhem.
Yeah. And, I know that you covered just recently this shooting over mm-hmm. in Virginia of Steve Scalise, the shootings, the targeting of mm-hmm. the Republican members of Congress. What does that do? You hang around there a lot. Mm-hmm. These are friends as well as people you cover. I guess it's okay to say, but I mean...
Well, they're human.
Yes.
I mean, you have human relationships,
yeah.
and that's normal and natural, and I think actually good, especially in a town like Washington.
Yeah, but my question is, I mean, we saw the great outpouring in mm-hmm. the aftermath of that, and this great hope that somehow mm-hmm. this would create a new spirit of comedy with a T, but... Mm-hmm. But that's not really what happens, is it?
It's not. I mean, I remember from Gabby Giffords. I was talking to Gabby Giffords just off the House floor the Thursday or Friday before she was shot, and I remember her telling me all about this great trip she and her family had taken to the Vatican, and we were just, you know, kibitzing. I wasn't trying to get information from her. And, you know, then she was shot. She almost didn't make it. And after that, you remember, I think you were working at the White House at the time. There was, again, this burst of comedy, of the need to dial it back, and and everybody started sitting together at the State of the Union addresses, and
Republicans and Democrats mixed together,
it's nice for a little while, but then it wears off, and the reality of the very harsh political discourse comes back.
How have things changed in the years that you've been covering Congress? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have my own feelings about this because I've been around a few more years than you, but you've been here quite a few by now. And how has the environment of the Congress and this town changed over the course of your tenure as a reporter?
Bipartisanship did not used to be a dirty word. Compromise did not used to be a dirty word. I can't tell you how many blisters I ended up getting on my feet from standing in hallways outside of meetings where Democrats, Republicans, representatives from the White House, Democrat and Republican White Houses, were behind closed doors having genuine discussions about really important legislation and how to do it in a bipartisan way. And the question wasn't, are they going to come out with, you know, a compromise, or is this just going to die? It was, what is that compromise going to be? There was so much faith in the system and in the grown-ups in the room, frankly, that it was a given that there would be something that would come out. You know, it might not have been perfect, but, you know, it was the days of Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch and John Warner. And I mean, Orrin Hatch is still there, but it just, it doesn't work for him. The system doesn't work for him the way it did. And it's not like that anymore. And it's really too bad.
Who were some of the most impactful people that you dealt with? Who are the people who impressed you the most?
Definitely Ted Kennedy is one of them. I mean, by far on the Democratic side, because, you know, for so many reasons, but because his dreams of becoming president didn't happen, and he poured his heart and soul into learning the art of legislating and to what it takes to be really impactful in the United States Senate. And he did it. Yeah. He did some great, great things.
What's interesting about him is that he became a target for Republican campaigns. Mm-hmm. He was always the poster child in the way that Nancy Pelosi is now. And yet he was well-liked by people on both sides of the aisle. Within within the walls of the Senate, he was as popular as anyone.
No question. I mean, Orrin Hatch was one of his very good friends.
Spoke at his memorial service,
exactly.
As
did John McCain. I remember being invited to MC a charity, with Catholic Charities, that was co-founded by Ted Kennedy and John Boehner. And they worked very closely together
on
this.
Right, they're both on the education committee.
Exactly. So there's no question he was very well liked. And on the Republican side, people like John Warner, who was kind
former
of the
senator from Virginia.
Senator from Virginia, the ultimate Virginia gentleman. And, you know, like all of these guys, they make their enemies. But he wanted to do right. And he knew that he was going to get hammered at home a lot for working on bipartisan legislation, and he didn't always do it, just like Ted Kennedy didn't always do it, but he did it enough, and he did it where he thought it really would be most impactful to the people who needed it.
How do we navigate around this period, just as someone who observes politics closely? And let me ask you, we'll answer that, and then I have a kind of harder question. That seems like a hard question, but I've got an even harder question.
Well, it is a hard question because the answer used to be, fundraising. And so much of the time and energy that these politicians spend, especially in the House where they're basically always running because they are on the ballot every 2 years, having to go across the street because you can't raise money in the Capitol and dial for dollars, or go to fundraisers at night in times where they could and probably should be having a drink with somebody across the aisle the way it used to be. it's not that simple anymore, because now a person can win with grassroots fervor and a social media and an internet presence with almost no money at all. So
they also mostly don't have to worry about a general election. In most cases, right. They're only worried about some right-wing challenge.
That's right.
And or left-wing challenge.
And that's the look, and at the end of the day, that's the real answer. The real answer is, and I've seen it, the gerrymandering is horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And I've had Republican, when I say gerrymandering, I mean that the only challenge that most Republicans have to worry about is from the right. So their interest is always to be drawn to the right. Less so among Democrats, but a lot of Democratic districts are drawn very heavily Democratic.
Right. So sometimes by Republican legislatures to get all Democrats in one district.
Exactly. I remember covering Congress when there were moderate Republicans from the North, New England Republicans, who was in their interest to represent their constituents to work with Democrats because there were. Those were the people who...
And conservative Democrats from the South.
And conservative Blue Dog Democrats from the South. Exactly right. And that was a lot of the basis for compromise, which doesn't exist anymore. And I've had really conservative Republicans say to me in the halls of Congress, even a couple of weeks ago, that there's more and more quiet talk about how it's not fun anymore and that they're also worried about a challenge from the right. They feel like they can't make a move without doing, you know, without the right being okay with it, and that maybe more Republicans and more conservatives are going to be interested in redistricting and that those kinds of reforms.
Well, this is certainly what drove Boehner out of the House.
No question.
The harder question I wanted to ask you is what role, and I include myself in this now because I'm over here at CNN as well. But the modern media environment, the whole breaking news mentality, the need to get eyeballs and therefore to take what may not be the most cataclysmic story and assign great importance to it so that people have a reason to come back 24/7 and watch. Conflict is more interesting than comedy with a T again.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's absolutely true. I think it was probably always the case in journalism, but the conflict historically has been about ideas, which is what this country is supposed to be about, a conflict of ideas and trying to figure out what the best idea is. I think that it's not just cable news. I think it's even across the board, even the gray lady has to deal with this, that it's not
New York Times,
that it's the conflict. The notion of conflict has taken on a life of its own.
I think it has to do also with competitive pressures. I mean, the
definitely.
News business is very competitive now with social media, the internet. Mm-hmm. I know I never had to file every hour or two
exactly.
when I was a reporter, but that is now a demand.
Do you see it differently? I mean, since you've been a reporter, obviously, like you said, you don't have to file every hour or two. You didn't have to worry about the internet.
I was reporting just after the Gutenberg press came out. But you had time to edit. You had time to report, and editors had time to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had what were called news cycles, where you were filing by 9 o'clock at night for the next morning's paper. Mm-hmm. And so you had a whole day to report out your story. And that's a luxury that most reporters don't have anymore.
No.
And I think and there is this competitive pressure to be first. Mm-hmm. And first used to mean to get it in the morning paper. Now it means within the next 10 minutes.
Yep.
And I think that reporting suffers under those kinds of pressures. A lot of great work's being done, but also a lot of stories aren't put in the proper context.
The context is key. That's exactly right. And you know, especially when, you know, if you're able to get a story out and get it out first, it's usually with a link on Twitter to the broader piece, which has context. That doesn't always happen. And you're limited to, what is Twitter, 140 characters.
Yes.
Which, as we've learned from the guy who's in the White House, doesn't always allow you the space to give enough context to what you're trying to say.
There are times when zero characters would suit better. It would be better for him and the country if he abided by that limitation. Let me ask you about a couple of figures who you've covered over the years. Nancy Pelosi has come under fire recently from some of her own troops after the result in Georgia. I thought kind of unfairly.
I agree.
Because that was always going to be a difficult district. And I think they would have depicted John Ossoff as a liberal, were there a Nancy Pelosi.
It would have helped if he lived in the district where he was.
Well, he had no roots. He was an unknown, basically, to the district. And yet, he came awfully close to winning a district that had been in Republican hands for 40 years. Mm-hmm. But there is this disconsternation among younger members because you've got a bunch of septuagenarians mm-hmm. who in the leadership, including Pelosi. My experience with her is that she's an extraordinary, tough, smart, mm-hmm. canny person, and she was unbelievably helpful to Barack Obama when he was president. But do the younger members have a point about the need for new leadership?
Yes, I think they do. I think they all have points, and that's the problem. I think that the younger members do see there's Nancy Pelosi, there's Steny Hoyer, they're about the same age. There's Clyburn, who's not that far behind, maybe even a few years older, and those are the leaders in their party. They do have younger people who they bring to the table for that exact reason, but. Listen, I am somebody, I've observed Nancy Pelosi for years. And yeah, she's been there for a long time. But you correct me if I'm wrong, because you were in the White House. I do not think Obamacare would have gone through if she weren't the leader.
Not a chance.
She knows her caucus. She is, here's why she is a leader that's going to be very hard to compare with. She knows her caucus, hundreds of people. So well, I mean, and not just their kids' names, their grandkids' birthdays, their sign, their favorite color, you know, what they ate for breakfast, but kind of what makes them tick. And it's because of that that she can hold them and she can get things done. And I think that the fact that she pushed back during the Obamacare fight, the very lengthy one, where when the Senate lost the 60th vote, when Scott Brown won in Massachusetts, and tell me if these stories are wrong, but from everything we hear, she was one of the people who stood up and said, "No, this is our chance. We got to do this," and she willed it.
I think there were two people who took that position. One was Barack Obama, and the mm-hmm. other was Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. and it wouldn't have happened otherwise. She well, let me take a short break, and I'll be right back with Dana Bash. One of my favorite Pelosi stories was that I was not in this meeting, but it was reported to me that one of her members from a more conservative district was unhappy about a vote or something that she was asking them to take. And she was walking out of the room, and the member said, "It's easy for her to say, she's from San Francisco." And she turned around and came back to this member and pointed her finger in his chest and said, "Listen, I spend every weekend away from my grandchildren to raise money from liberals for people like you." She said, "So don't give me that." And she walked out of the room, and then all the members turned on that guy and said, "You owe her an apology."
Exactly.
It goes to your point.
Exactly. And look, she's I mean, talk about badass women. She is the ultimate.
And we are going to talk about
badass women.
We will,
but she's the ultimate badass because she rules. Maybe badass isn't even the way to. She's old school. She rules
people forget she's the daughter of the mayor of Baltimore.
Who and her job when she was a little girl was to help make the index cards for her father about whose favors that they owe or who owes him favors.
Right.
I mean, that's the knee that she learned on.
Right.
And
she's not an effete San Francisco liberal comes to politics.
Not at all.
Let me ask you about Mitch McConnell, mm-hmm. Who, you know, I think I have to give him credit for diabolical cleverness. He made a decision back in 2009 that bipartisan cooperation was not in his interest in terms of winning back seats for the Senate in the Congress generally. And, you know, he was the first resist movement.
Mm-hmm. He was.
And he enforced that discipline on his members. We tried, when I was in the White House, to get cooperation on the health bill, kept it open, as you remember, for mm-hmm. months and months and months as Democratic members tried to get Republicans to come along. President met with them. They said, "We can't, you know, it's a policy being enforced here on a strategy being enforced." And that's the way the 8 years went. And he forced President Obama to become more and more of a partisan, I think, and undercut one of his core credentials. And then we had the Garland situation where he held the Supreme Court open seat open. And now we have health care. And we have a health care bill that may come to the floor this week, never having had a public hearing, 20 hours of amendments, and then a vote on something of enormous magnitude. Talk about McConnell as a personality in the context of the history I just...
Well, it's funny because if you look at McConnell and Pelosi, we were just talking about, and Harry Reid, who was ruled with the same kind of iron fist, but a very different approach to it, they all have one thing in common that I've been thinking about a lot lately, is that they have the thickest skin known to mankind. They just, they make a decision and they are willing to take the hits and to be the poster children for it. And, you know, for right or wrong, and that's just the way it goes. Mitch McConnell ate, you know what, for a year on the Supreme Court decision not to give Merrick Garland a vote, hoping and praying that there would be a Republican in the White House and it would be moot. And you know what? It paid off. It right or wrong, it was just a very intense political decision. And so that is Mitch McConnell in a nutshell. He's not Mr. Backslapper. He's certainly not a public speaker.
And he's not a policy guy.
He is the ultimate insider, tactician, political chess player. And I think that in so many ways, in the opposition, that helped him because of what you were just describing to how he positioned or forced the President Obama to position himself in a way that he didn't want to be. But it's the jury's still out on what it means now that he's in charge with the guy in the White House. Because, I mean, just one example that really surprised
me. That would be Donald Trump for those who aren't following along here.
For those who are on planet Mars. But just the rollout of their health care bill. Never mind that they were doing it behind closed doors. Whatever. Okay, that happens on both sides of the aisle. But when it was time to unveil it, it was just thrown online. There was nobody who came out and did as much as a press conference and said, "Here's why this is good for America." So what it did was it left a giant vacuum, and Chuck Schumer smartly jumped right into that vacuum and all of the opponents to try to define this bill as negative. And that was a very big mistake, I thought, from the perspective of Mitch McConnell, in that he let that vacuum happen. However, let's just get into like the real conspiracy talk. Unless it is that those who say that he just doesn't care and he wants his off his plate and he didn't want to fight for it, and maybe he's kind of okay with Obamacare staying in the land.
There is a theory here that this is a terrible bill from a political standpoint.
Exactly.
You're giving the base what they want in the short run. But in the long run, you know, when you're giving $1 billion of tax cuts primarily to very rich people and taking away health care from tens of millions of people, that elderly, people with disabilities and so on, that's a, like, those are negative ads ready-made.
Exactly. And let's just say that this does become law, just as you said, and let's just say the policy works and people, their health care and their health insurance situation is better. In the short term, there's no way that's going to happen because it's not even written that way. So in the short term, they're definitely going to take a political hit. But you're saying that your theory is that he does not want to be
accused by the base of being the guy who stopped this repeal and replace. I also do think,
but he doesn't want to sell it to the point where he realizes it's actually in the long term going to hurt.
I mean, there's
the party.
A theory that could be.
I think that's legit.
I mean, look, tax breaks for the wealthy and cutting back the welfare state and sticking it to Barack Obama are three of the favorite things of Republicans. So I don't want to discount that possibility, but strategically, because he does think strategically, not being the guy who's caught out of the chair in a game of musical chairs on this thing, and yet not having it succeed, might be the best of all worlds. So where does this healthcare bill go? McConnell has made a big time gamble to throw it out there. It's clear he doesn't have the votes yet. There's a ton of pressure on these senators, although they'd get more if they recessed and went home.
I agree.
What's your bet on whether he gets these votes?
you know, pretty much every 5 minutes, if you ask me, I have a different kind of feeling on it. At this moment, I would say it's more likely than not that it dies, that it doesn't pass. You know, on the just on the moderate side, Dean Heller is out there, and it's very hard to imagine them putting enough money in there for Medicaid and figuring out a way to magically make the CBO show that that premiums are going to go down for people. The big issues that he has,
and if they did, to hold the right.
That's exactly right. So I'm guessing that he's going to be hard to get. Susan Collins, another moderate, seems hard to get. She also has another a lot of things weighing on her, like is she going to run for governor, which is a whole different set of kind of political considerations and constituent considerations. So they can only lose two, right? So there you have two. And then, okay, well, what about Rand Paul, who is pretty much consistently in the hell no category? But he's also the junior senator from Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell is. So does he feel enough of a kind of allegiance to Mitch McConnell?
Well, their relationship has been a little stormy over the years. Mitch McConnell didn't support him when he ran originally.
That's true. He didn't support him when he ran originally.
Or for president. But, maybe he did. I don't know.
But, well, he basically said he was going to, I think, pretty much stay out. But by the time that Rand Paul ran for president, they had come together because Rand Paul saved Mitch McConnell's you-know-what. Rand Paul really worked very hard when Mitch McConnell had a tough primary fight in Kentucky.
Yes.
And to help him win.
He did.
And so they have a kind of a marriage of convenience.
Maybe he feels he's paid his debt.
Maybe. And that's the other thing. I mean, you know, Rand Paul is, regardless of what you think about his convictions, he is truly a man of conviction.
I believe that.
So if that's three.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's hard to imagine, even if they do try to appease and appeal to those moderates, you're going to lose.
There's not enough wrapping paper to cover the package.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
What about the guy in the White House? What are you hearing from Republicans on the Hill about him? Privately, we know what they say publicly.
He's incredibly communicative. He loves to be on that phone, on his cell phone, by the way, still. Did President Obama use his cell phone in the Oval Office?
No.
His personal
In fact,
cell phone?
I don't think he was able to use his cell phone for anything but email.
Oh, well, that changed, obviously.
Yes.
But he
didn't want the Russians to know what he was saying, so it's different.
So anyway, he's on his cell phone all the time. I wonder if it's going to change now that his family is actually in the residence, but I'm not so sure. But because he was kind of rattling around in the White House from 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. And so he talks to people all the time, even people you would not suspect that he would talk to, who he doesn't have a long, wonderful, warm history with. A lot of it, he does a lot of ruminating about, do you think I should get rid of Reince Priebus? Or what do you think I should do?
I guess he does a lot of ruminating and sometimes some fulminating too. Huh?
Yes. Yeah. But there is still a sliver of hope among even his sharpest Republican critics that on some issues, maybe not any domestic issues, frankly, but on some national security and international issues, putting Russia aside, Iraq, Afghanistan, that he's still a kind of a blank slate that they can help form.
Well, they have Mattis here, who they all have Mattis.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, this whole tweeting thing causes such heartburn. You can imagine, you're a member of Congress and you're walking through the hallways and you're going to cast a vote on whatever issue it is that you said that you wanted. And the only thing that happens is you're asked by reporters about the latest tweet that the president sent. And it's not because we're obsessed with a random tweet. It's because it has consequential impact.
He's not tweeting about the weather.
He's not.
No. So, no, I think it's difficult for them. I think it's difficult for the White House staff. I asked Sean Spicer when he was at the University of Chicago at my mm-hmm. Institute of Politics whether he knew what the president was going to be tweeting, and he said no. And I said, well, how do you sleep at night? He said, no, I sleep okay. He said, but I wake up early and look at my phone first thing to see what I'm going to be dealing with that day.
And the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's everybody's first, you know, certainly in this town, the first thing you do is you wake up and you look at the president's Twitter feed to see what the day is going to bring.
And really fast, because I want to talk about mm-hmm. this great web series that you've done. Where do you think this probe story is going, at least from the congressional end? I mean, how committed do you think the Congress is to actually looking at these issues?
I think the Senate Intelligence Committee is really genuinely committed in a bipartisan way. Richard Burr, to this moment, has stepped up in a way that, frankly, that
he's the chairman, senator chairman from North
of the,
Carolina.
Chairman of the Intelligence Committee, also not running for re-election. He just won, which, you know, kind of takes the shackles, the political shackles off of anybody. I think even his Democratic colleagues are surprised at how seriously he's taking this. So, you know, where it goes and what the end result will be, who knows? But I think that's legit. The House is a mess. The House Intelligence Probe is a mess. Even though there are a lot of people who have really good intentions, it just, the chairman, Devin Nunes, and the weird, bizarre stuff that happened with him and the White House, and that just set that off, and I don't think there's really a way for it to come back.
So only 20% of the Congress are women. That's about the same percentage as hold executive offices in the states, and it seems to be pretty consistent in our politics. But you have taken a look at some sort of iconic women in this wonderful web series, Badass Women of Washington. Tell me about why you decided to do this, and what did you learn?
We decided to do it after Hillary Clinton lost, and I was having lunch with a couple of colleagues and talking about kind of the prospect for another female who could and would be in the running to be the party's nominee, never mind actually winning the presidency. And I said, wait a minute, you guys, there's so many women who we cover every day who are already making incredible strides and broke barrier after barrier after barrier. And it just kind of, it took off from there. And so what I wanted to do was talk to a cross-section of women when it comes to their politics, generation, geography, and it was fascinating to actually spend time like you and I are doing now, away from the, you know, 15-second sound bites, and to really get to know their stories and where they came from, and, you know, whether it's Dianne Feinstein, who has
I recommend that episode to anyone, because she has such an extraordinary story.
She does.
Almost 85 years old.
Yep, she turned 84.
She just delivers in so well and so strongly. Mm-hmm.
She was the first woman president of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, which is a huge deal. Then, because of a double murder, she became the mayor, then became the first female mayor and won in her own right for 10 years. She was there for 10 years and then became the first woman elected from California to the United States Senate.
Lost a race for governor.
She lost for governor, yeah. And that's the one, there's so many lessons from her discussion. But the key for me was actually how I ended the piece, was her advice to younger women. You're going to get defeated. And you take defeat after defeat after defeat. You stand up, you brush yourself off, and you do it again.
Yeah. She's tough.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes across. And that's, she manages to be tough without being acerbic.
Yes.
Which is a great quality.
It is. And it's not easy for women, even in today's day and age.
What do you think the women in Washington, particularly the Congress, bring? When I started in politics, I think I was around when Barbara Mikulski moved up from the House to the Senate. She was the first Democratic woman in the Senate. Now, you know, you have a much larger number, but still not nearly a majority. What do they bring to the debate here? And would things be different if, say, half the members were women?
I do think it would be different if half the members were women. I genuinely am not just saying this. I think that we probably would have more things that get done because by example, the women who are there tend to look, women are problem solvers. It's what we do. We multitask and we problem solve. Whether it's figuring out how to get your kid from point A to point B or creating policy as they are now for some of the most important parts of American society. And so, and just it's seeing the way that Barbara Mikulski and Kay Bailey Hutchison on the Republican side, she retired as well. Both of them started this dinner club in the Senate, and they meet once a month, off the record, no notes, a little bit of wine, and they get to know each other as people. And so many pieces of bipartisan legislation have come from that because they get to know each other. It's old school, like I was talking about with, you know, Ted Kennedy and the people who used to get things done across party lines. And so there's a lot of that. And, you know, look, women also just have different perspectives and come just like different people of various walks of life, gender, in a gender neutral way. The approach is different.
Yeah. I want to say this in such a way that I don't, but I think there's a temperament element here. There's not fighting for fighting's sake.
Exactly.
You know,
it's not that women don't have egos. Women have egos, but it's not the same.
You have to have egos to be in politics.
Yeah.
But you don't see the testosterone issue, which too often intrudes in our politics.
Jean Shaheen said she's a senator from New Hampshire. Again, first female governor.
I remember her when she was running New Hampshire for Gary Hart.
Exactly.
Back in 1984.
Exactly. So she was the first governor, female governor in New Hampshire, first female senator from New Hampshire. But one of the reasons I wanted to talk to her is exactly that. She started out as a staffer and as a campaign aide and a strategist. And she jokes that she decided to run because all the men she was working for couldn't win. But she talks about the fact that in her experience, she another person who lost the first time she ran for the Senate, she went to the Harvard Institute of Politics, and that her experience was that women, obviously this is a generalization, but women for the most part want to run because they want to actually accomplish something and get something done. There's something that really burned them up on a local level or something that they saw on a national level. And sometimes men just want to be senator.
Patty Murray is a great example.
Perfect
of that,
example.
Who started off on school issues.
Yep.
And wound up
now
she's one
shoes.
Of the leading Democrats in the Senate.
And she did one of the few pieces of real bipartisan legislation that we've seen in the last 5 years. She did it with Paul Ryan, but she worked really hard across party lines, and she got it done.
Well, for my money, you, Dana Bash, are one of the badass women of Washington.
And you say that to all the girls.
I do not. And a great colleague. And I
back
feel
you,
lucky
David.
To work with you. And thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my honor.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.